And welcome back to Coast. Don't forget, we're going to have live programs for you now on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day night. We're going to be here for you with some surprises and some special guests and all kinds of things. So make sure that you're gathered around the old, wherever you are, to listen to our Christmas Eve special and our Christmas night program for you on Coast to Coast AM. When I come back, we're going to continue our dialogue with Dr. Michael Shermer, the skeptic, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Back about life after death, if we can. I know it's difficult because one might say, well, there is no true fact. You don't have evidence, hard evidence there. But so many people, for example, Michael, say that they see ghosts or their dearly departed loved ones visiting them somehow, either in their dream state or sending them special messages, which helps them out. I can't refute that, but you seem to. How come?
Well, actually, I don't think anybody could refute it. I mean, by definition, somebody who has a one-off personal revelatory type experience, they heard the voice of God, or they heard their lost loved one from the other side, or they saw a ghost or whatever. I can't prove that didn't happen. What I can do is offer a neuroscience explanation or some kind of physical environment explanation. For example, haunted houses are often old, creaky buildings with old pipes that creak, and maybe there's a train track nearby and the train goes by and rattles things, or there might be something with the lighting and shading. And I can explore some ideas like that. Typically what happens when I do that is that the experiencer ups the ante by making it more and more difficult for me to explain it by adding components to the story that I suspect probably didn't happen. We all do that, exaggerate our stories. But that aside, in terms of like the kinds of experiences people have in their brains that we know, like temporal lobe seizures, and like Michael Persinger's lab at Laurentian University, with the God helmet. I think you're familiar with that.
Yes.
You bombard your temporal lobes with these radio frequencies, electromagnetic frequencies, and he generates a sense of floating out of your body, and sense presence in the room. And the sense presence in the room is an interesting one. A lot of people experience this, a sense that somebody else is here. There's a book out on the third man factor, I think it's called, where hikers, big climbers, that do Everest and K2 and so on, they often report feeling like there was an extra person with us.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't start the expedition with us, and several people on the expedition may in fact experience that, and that has something to do with probably with oxygen deprivation to the cortex. And see, the brain can't sense itself, so if there's something going on inside the brain that creates another sense of self, there can't be two selves. There's just one. It's me. I am me. I'm only me. And if I sense that there's somebody else in the room, well, that person has to be outside of my head. Can't be in my head. Schizophrenics, when they hear voices, they really hear external voices, even though we know that the voices are coming from inside their heads. And it's not just schizophrenics, so we all have this capacity to do this. And so I think that goes a long way to explaining this. We know that there's a Navy pilot physician who studies pilots that black out. It's part of their training program, these Top Gun right. pilots. And they're in the centrifuge. He spins them around and they black out. It's part of their training program to try not to black out by constricting the muscles in your neck and so on. Well, anyway, they all black out, and about 20%, one in five, have an out-of-body experience. Well, we know what the cause of that is. It's hypoxia, oxygen deprivation to the cortex. And so if you can artificially generate it through Persinger's God helmet or through oxygen deprivation, or, that goes a long way to explaining like near-death experiences after drowning, or an accident where there's, where you're knocked unconscious, or you're under anesthesia and you don't get as much oxygen, say, that goes a long way to helping us understand that. It doesn't prove or disprove that there's an afterlife, but it does indicate that it's probably in the head.
Okay, what about reincarnation? I've had numerous discussions with family members and with a psychologist who have talked to a little boy from the Midwest who started talking about some World War II things about a plane. They're convinced that he was a pilot who had died in World War II.
Uh-huh.
And the psychologist is now convinced that there's something strange here too. God, you hear that stuff, Michael, and you got to go, you know what? This could be real. Michael Shermer would say, no, kid, you got a vivid imagination. You saw a TV show.
Children do have vivid imaginations, and they get sources of information from, especially now, the Internet, that their parents don't know, may not know about. I mean, it's easy to get information when you're a little kid about World War II airplanes. I mean, I think when I was 5 or 6, I was, you know, just devouring this stuff. You know, kids love all that World War II stuff. So I'm not particularly impressed with that one. You know, there's that whole book of these things of, you know, the kid who thinks he was a Civil War soldier because he's got a weird scar, birthmark on his side where the soldier was shot, something like that. So there's a couple problems with reincarnation that I see. One is the population problem. That is the demographics. You know, there's 6 billion people alive now. We estimate there's been about 100 billion people who have ever lived, going back to roughly 50,000 years, obviously a back-of-the-envelope calculation. But roughly speaking, 100 billion have lived, 6 billion are alive today. So where are all the others? If there's only 6 billion of us with an extra, you know, coming back as an extra person from before, where's the other 94 billion go? I mean, where are their souls floating around in purgatory or something, you know, some way station? So I think that's part of the problem with reincarnation, just logistically speaking. But usually most of the stories I hear are so anecdotal that, you know, they depend on first person accounts and then somebody recording what was remembered. And, you know, we're not real good eyewitness. We don't have really good eyewitness memory. We distort things, we change things, we exaggerate stories of the fantastic. Everybody does it. So I'm not especially convinced with those, no matter how many there are, because, you know, once the rumor gets out that people are telling stories like this, like the recovered memory movement, then other people start recovering memories of their past lives, not just earlier life, but past lives. That's what also made me suspicious about the recovering an alien abduction experience through hypnosis. We do have really vivid imaginations. That's why half the New York Times bestseller list is made up of fiction.
Sure.
We're good at fiction. It's what we do. We make stuff up. And if we're not really making stuff up consciously, we may be making it up subconsciously because we have a powerful subconscious as well.
Well, let me ask you something about the... It's related, I guess, to this. Angels, of course. I get a call from a truck driver who tells me he was falling asleep at the wheel.
Uh-huh.
He was going over a cliff. He wakes up, sees a hand on his steering wheel, pulling him back on the road. It's not his hand. He said, I don't know where it came from, what it was, but it woke me up. And I was back on. Are you saying he imagined that?
Oh, or? Yeah, that sounds like a disassociation effect, in fact, that could happen under like a sort of, what is called a hypnopompic hallucination.
So you're going to tell him there was no angelic experience?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he probably...
Go ahead, say it. Say it to him. He's listening now, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think probably it's a kind of a disassociation type of what we call a hypnopompic hallucination that is just as you're falling asleep. Or and there's another one called a hypnagogic hallucination, just as you're waking up. Quite a few people, quite a sizable percentage of the population has these little experiences where they hear voices, they have a sense presence, they feel like somebody's talking to them or touching them. That's not actually that unusual. And if this guy was falling asleep, that's it. That's a hypnopompic hallucination right there.
So let's review just a little bit here. So Dr. Michael Shermer believes that the 9/11 tragedy was caused solely by the Al-Qaeda types. Am I accurate there for you?
That's right, yeah. Which is, by the way, a conspiracy. By definition, 19 members of Al-Qaeda plotted to fly planes into buildings secretly without telling anybody.
Two of them would have been a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Michael Shermer believes that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman, acted alone in the assassination of John F. Kennedy, correct?
No question about it in my mind.
Believes that nothing will really happen at 2012.
Except for
2013.
Yeah.
Does not believe in life after death. So when we die, that's it.
That's it.
That's kind of sad for all of us.
No, I don't feel sad at all. You know, it doesn't bother me in the least. You know why? Because I was not aware of what I was missing before I was born. So I won't know what I'm missing when I'm dead. I mean, you have to experience, you know, a sense of tragedy or loss, you actually have to be conscious. And if you're dead, you're not experiencing anything. So I'm really not worried about it.
If it turns out
I'm wrong, you know, well, giddy. I'll be okay.
So you are open to the fact that you could be wrong about some of these.
Well, of course.
That's dramatic.
Any good scientist should, you know, must keep an open mind. To a certain extent, that's
well. You do know the headline of a good newspaper would be, Dr. Michael Shermer says he could be wrong.
Well, you know, I was a global warming skeptic, and I changed my mind about that. And I could be changed back, actually. The whole climate gate thing and the covering up of some of the data, that really bothers me.
That was damaging.
Yeah, I mean, it shows you how political these guys are on both sides. And so I could be flipped back on that. I really don't have a dog in that fight.
You don't believe in angels?
No, of course not.
And that means, I hate to go here, you don't believe in God.
No, I don't.
So how in the heck did we get here? A roll of the dice?
No, if it was just a roll of the dice, we certainly would not be here. The evolutionary process is not random. It's random variation, but non-random cumulative selection. And it's the non-random cumulative selection part that creates complexity and apparent design, things like wings and eyes and cells and whatnot. That's not randomness. That's definitely not chance. We would not be here if that was the case.
Intelligence behind it?
Well, I think there's built into it, into the system, a propensity to go from simple to complex. That appears to be part of nature. And I do like the work of complexity theorists and chaos theorists who talk about this sort of inherent nature built into nature to go from simple to complex, for emergent properties to happen, for water to come out of H2O, for consciousness to come out of a bunch of neurons firing, that we do have these emergent properties. But I don't think that's a top-down design, as in a supernatural being who reaches into our space and time from where, who knows, and stirs the particles in a way to create, say, living cells or DNA or the eye or whatever. I don't think that's the case. A bottom-up creative process, I think, definitely exists that produced all this complexity that we have. But that's not something somebody would pray to, certainly.
So who are we? What are we, in your opinion?
We're a social primate species with an amazing brain capable of awareness and self-awareness and what's called theory of mind. That is, I can read your mind in a way, not psychically, but I know that you know that I know, and I know that you know that I know that you know, and we have this meta capacity for deep thought, and I think that makes us very special. As far as we know, no other chimps or dogs can do what we can do in terms of reflecting upon that kind of level of depth. And that's who we are. I mean, we are our own species, but we're definitely connected to all of the species on Earth, no question about it. And I think that by itself is fantastic enough to warrant, you know, feeling very fortunate and spiritual and transcendent and all the stuff that religion supposedly gives people. I feel that just from the study of nature and the wonder that we're here at all, I think is worthy of respect and awe.
Is it safe to say you're more of an agnostic than an atheist?
Well,
as an agnostic wants proof, an atheist won't believe no matter what.
Yeah, well, technically, an atheist is just somebody without theism, an atheist. Unfortunately, a lot of atheists sort of go farther. We call them strong atheists or militant atheists. That, you know, they go so far as to say there is no God. Well, you can't really say that. We don't know that for sure. So as a statement about the universe, agnostic really is the right word. It was coined by Thomas Huxley, and you disagree with Huxley at your own peril. He was a pretty smart guy. And he said that there are certain questions in life you simply can't answer. through science, and God is one of those. So agnostic, just simply, it's just simply not knowable. Not that I don't know, but I'm keeping an open mind, and it could go one way or the other, and maybe one more experiment will tip the scale. No, it's that it's not knowable, period. And that's the end, you know, full stop. So, but of course, no one's an agnostic behaviorally. You don't get up Sunday morning trying to decide what to do. You're either going to church or you're staying home to watch the ball game, or in my case, go for a bike ride or whatever. You know, you actually do make a behavioral decision. So to that extent, I'm an atheist. I just don't believe in God.
Do you, or have you ever prayed in order to help yourself or your loved ones or somebody was sick? Did you ever say, please, I hope you're okay, or anything like that?
Oh, I did. Yes. I was pretty religious for about 7 years. I was a born-again evangelical Christian in high school, in my senior year, and all through my 4 years of undergraduate school.
What changed your mind? Something happened to you.
A number of things. One is the study of comparative world religions and sort of the awareness that they're all making mutually exclusive claims about the world, and they're all claiming to have, you know, tapping into the one true religion, and they have the one true God, and all that. And so on one level, I realized, well, that can't be right. You know, somebody's wrong, and these guys believe as strongly as I believe, so what if I'm wrong? But that wasn't quite it either. It was also a social factor of when I was at Pepperdine, everybody I knew was a born-again evangelical Christian, so there was no dissent. When I was in graduate school, nobody was religious, or at least I didn't know about it. It just never came up. It was just not of interest. And so we were just there to do science. And so it actually became okay to dissent, to think, you know, maybe it's not true or whatever. And that became acceptable. And then finally, the final thing that sort of tipped the scale for me was, I just wrote about this. I've never written about it before, but I'd already decided there probably wasn't a God, and I was sort of going down that road. And my college sweetheart, a woman named Maureen, who was from Alaska,
mm-hmm.
and I had dated for 5-6 years, and she was in a car accident, and she was in a sleep in the back of a van. She was out in the middle of the night doing working for an inventory company out in the middle of nowhere. And anyway, this van rolled and snapped her back and broke her back, and she was paralyzed. And so we brought her back here to Long Beach Memorial, where they have a hyperbaric chamber, and stuffed her inside this chamber to try to force oxygen into her spine. Gosh, this was a grim experience. I mean, I was there for, you know, days and weeks on end, and, you know, all the other people that are there in the emergency room, and it was just grim. And she was really a sweetheart. She's still alive, but she's still paralyzed. But I did, at that point, I thought, you know what, I'm just going to give this one more shot, you know, because it really doesn't matter what I believe. I mean, I'd really like there to be a God, and if anybody deserves to be healed, it's Maureen. I mean, she's really a good person, and if there is any justice in the universe, if there's anybody that would make things right, this would certainly be the time for a God to do such a thing. So I did. I got down, I took a knee, and there in the hospital, and I prayed fervently, you know, with all my heart. I really believed, I really wanted it to be true. And, you know, nothing happened, of course. And you know, people, of course, had explanations for me. Well, you know, God works in mysterious ways, or he has a special plan for Maureen or whatever. Anyway, I thought, you know, that's just so lame. That just doesn't do it for me.
Maybe, Michael, maybe it didn't work because you really didn't believe it. You were more testing it. Let's talk about that when we come back. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with the skeptic, Dr. Michael Shermer. And, of course, in our fourth hour tonight, Michael Horn joins us with some incredible information about some UFO stories. Up next, Dr. Michael Shermer on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Dr. Michael Shermer as we talk about a number of issues. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls. Michael, getting back to, you know, prayer and faith, and I see, I've been a long believer that, you know, the system is more than just a one-time help me out. It's more of an ongoing. And, you know, and maybe because you didn't have that ongoing faith, maybe that's why it didn't work for you.
Maybe. But I think why should it matter what I believe? I mean, if there's a good and just God who's all powerful and all knowing, I mean, first of all, why does he need me to remind him of who needs help? He doesn't. So what is it I'm doing when I'm praying anyway? So even that's a little problematic. But even so, why should Maureen suffer just because I had lapses of faith? I mean, that also doesn't seem fair. And in any case, why belief? I mean, why the whole business about, you know, I'm the Lord your God, a jealous God? I mean, a jealous God? I mean, jealousy is a human emotion. I mean, I know people that have gotten over jealousy. I've gotten over jealousy. I mean, surely God can get over jealousy. I mean, it's so fraught with, you know, human-type characteristics, like the Greek gods. Greek gods had all sorts of, you know, superhuman emotions, but they were human emotions. And so the problem of evil, I think, is an insurmountable one for the believer, that, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? And the answers given, you know, are things like, well, God works in mysterious ways, or he has special plans, or you'll gain greater depth of character from suffering, or mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Those seem kind of shallow. They seem indistinguishable from a universe that has no God at all, and stuff just happens.
Or maybe the God that so many of us believe in doesn't have that kind of ability. Maybe I'll call it he, for lack of a better gender here, but maybe he can't step in and make you well or make you not. Maybe there's something else involved here.
Indeed, right. Perhaps it's a limited God. That's entirely possible. A God who's just like a sophisticated genetic engineer that can create cellular life and then lets
it happen.
And then beyond that, just stuff happens. Yeah, that's possible. But how that would be indistinguishable from, say, an extraterrestrial intelligence.
True.
That a lot of your listeners think have already come here. Well, let's say they are out there, whether they've come here or not. Let's say they are out there, and you don't have to be very more advanced than we are to be able to create life. We're pretty close to doing this. You know, J. Craig Venter has a lab that's very close to creating living organisms from nothing. And he's not the only one. So, but let's say he can't do it. Let's say it doesn't happen in our lifetime. Maybe it happens 50 years from now or 500 years from now. It's going to happen. Well, any extraterrestrial intelligence we would encounter is not likely to be right in parallel, lockstep with us culturally. They're either going to be way ahead of us or way behind us. And if we encounter them, they're not likely to be way behind us because they won't come here. You have to have spacecraft to get here or something like that. So you'd have to be ahead of us. So the chances of them being just like, say, 50 years ahead of us or something like that. That's what always bothered me about the Roswell story, you know, that they came here and gave us transistors because we were stuck with vacuum tubes. You know, oh, come on, that's like a 5-year improvement in technology. Any aliens we're going to encounter, they're going to be so far advanced that our technologies will look like wooden sticks and stone tools. So surely any ET would be able to create complex life, cells, DNA, self-replicating molecules. So how would that be any different from what we describe as God?
Well, let me ask you this, and this is going to take a very deep answer from you, because if some miracle had occurred that day you prayed and she was miraculously cured, something happened, her spine was fine, she was able to walk again, would that have changed you from that point on? I mean, would Dr. Michael Shermer, the skeptic, not have existed as a skeptic?
Maybe, yeah, because I wasn't really into being I wasn't Mr. Skeptic at all. I was just a young man. and I was not. I didn't have a social or financial commitment to being Mr. Skeptic. And in any case, I could be changed again now, because my main job really is as a scientist, and Skeptic Magazine is really a science magazine. So, you know, if it turns out there was a God, it really wouldn't change a lot of the stuff that we do.
Right.
So I'm not, you know, beholden to that. But still, your question's a really good one. I think at that particular point, it might have changed me. Now, if something really spectacular happened that was, you know, seemingly miraculous, it would be harder to swing me around, just like anybody. in a committed to a belief system politically or whatever, you know, the more you have invested in it, the more difficult it is to change your mind. That's just how belief systems work.
Have you ever had anything happen to you where, let's say, you were thinking about someone calling you and the phone rang and there they were?
Yeah, sure. That stuff happens.
All right. What do you categorize that?
As chance, you know, just stuff happens. I had one last couple months ago, and I was at spoke at the University of Toronto, and the next morning I had to get up really early. It was a Sunday morning to fly home, and so I'm down at the airport, that huge airport there at University in Toronto, and I'm reading the Toronto Globe and Mail, sort of the New York Times of Canada, and they have their huge Sunday book review section. So I was in the long security line that was snaking back and forth in a like a switchback fashion up toward the security check, and I'm reading on the back page of the book review section is a full page review of Franz de Waal's new book, The Age of Empathy, and it's about sort of the pre-moral sentiments of animals and apes and how chimpanzees have empathy and this sort of thing. Anyway, I'm reading this real positive review of Franz's book, and Franz is an old friend of mine, and I look up. And there is Franz de Waal standing right there in that line at 6 in the morning. And I'm like, what? Oh, my God, this is incredible.
See, and, Michael, just go a little further, and we've got you.
Well, but, you know, stuff.
We'll change the name of your magazine to the Unskeptical Magazine.
There you go.
And you're on your way. I like what you've said about patternicity. Why don't you explain that?
Patternicity, the tendency to find meaningful patterns in meaningless noise. We're pattern-seeking primates. We connect the dots. We connect A to B to C, and often A really is connected to B, and B really is connected to C, and that's called association learning. All animals do it. The problem is we don't have a baloney detection module in our brain, so we have a hard time telling the difference between true and false patterns. So, for example, like what Skinner showed with his little Skinner boxes with pigeons, if you train a pigeon to peck a key and give it food, in association with the pecking the key, it'll keep pecking the key. Or if you set it up in a pattern where it has to peck the left key, then the right key, then it gets fed, it'll do that. So that's just basically learning. It's like training your dog. But what he discovered was that if you put these pigeons on a variable interval schedule of reinforcement, that is, you don't just automatically give them a reinforcement every time they peck the key. You make them wait a while. And that period of time you make them wait is variable. Sometimes it's 2 seconds, sometimes it's 30 seconds. Whatever they happen to be doing just before the little grain hopper gave them the reward, that gets reinforced. So a lot of times these pigeons would be like hopping around, and they'd do like two hops to the left and circle around twice to the right, and then they'd get fed. Well, all of a sudden, they were repeating these bizarre behaviors, and that was superstition. And we all do that. You can see people, you can go to Vegas and watch this. People going through all kinds of rituals. And so that's patternicity. And the reason for it is because we really can't tell the difference between true and false patterns. So let's say you're a hominid on the plains of Africa and you hear a rustle in the grass. Is that a dangerous predator, or is it just the wind? Well, if you assume it's a dangerous predator and it turns out it's just the wind, you've made a type 1 error, a false positive. But no big deal, right? You just become a little more vigilant. You move away. You're cautious. You're kind of jittery like animals are on the plains of Africa. And you just move on. But if you make the other kind of error, you assume it's just the wind, it turns out it's a dangerous predator, you're lunch. And so there was you'd be taken out of the gene pool. So there was a natural selection then just to assume all patterns are real just in case. And that's in our nature. You'll always need Skeptic Magazine, so to speak. People will always believe weird things. Superstitions and magical thinking will always be with us because it's built into the brain.
Very good. Now, let's talk a little about UFOs before we get to the top of the hour and phone calls with you. You are a believer or not that life exists out there in the universe like ours.
I strongly suspect that there is intelligent life. For sure, I think there's bacterial-grade life all over the place, probably. That's the way it's looking now.
Yeah.
I think the harder step is to get from bacterial-grade life to complex life. Not just, I don't mean like complex cells, but actual communicating intelligent beings. You see, because you could take like the history of life on Earth and get all the way up to Neanderthals, and let's say we went extinct instead of Neanderthals, I don't think there's any evidence that they'd be building spaceships and running radio stations and sending beacons out to look for extraterrestrial signals or to send signals. I think we could have gotten all this way for 3.5 billion years, all the way up to 30,000 years ago, and we go extinct and there'd be nothing. There'd be no civilization like we have. So that's the hard step. Still, the best argument that the SETI people have is that 100 billion stars times 100 billion galaxies, and if only 10, 20% have planets, there just has to be intelligent communicating life out there. There just has to be. Sagan, you know, projected maybe a million in our galaxy, even if it's 1,000 or whatever, that's still impressive. And so I think that's a reasonable argument to make, that they're out there. But that's a all different right. question from have they come here?
Have they come here? You don't
very different. I don't think so.
What are people seeing? They're seeing something.
Yeah, they are. That's right. They're seeing all sorts of things. I mean, it depends on the particular sighting. Sometimes, I mean, the ufologists and me are in agreement on like 90% of the sightings. You know, oh, this was a weather balloon, or we know that was a rocket launch, or we know that was the stealth bomber. You know, the stealth bomber does explain a lot of them. People will say, oh, I saw this black triangular shaped, really quiet, spooky looking, you know, UFO.
Well, especially before we even knew it was a stealth bomber.
Yeah, and so I wonder what the Air Force has now that we haven't heard about yet. You know, out there in the desert where, you know, it's really clear and the air is dry and it's dusk and you can't quite make out what you're seeing, and we don't know about the whatever the new technology is. And you know, the fact that governments lie to their citizens. Well, this always amazes me when UFO people say, "Oh, they lied to us about Roswell," as if they couldn't believe that governments lie to their citizens.
Well, now that I was going to say, you do accept the fact that governments lie.
Oh boy, do they ever!
Okay, hey, we agree on something.
There we go.
We found it. But back to UFOs and visitations. Go ahead.
I was going to say, a terrestrial secret that you lie about, national security or Cold War secrets or whatever, does not translate into extraterrestrial.
No, not necessarily. I agree. My gosh, we're agreeing on two things now. But ancient texts will depict what could be craft, UFOs, old paintings in the 1500s of a lady standing by a building with a UFO behind her. Clearly a UFO. Which I don't think somebody etched on in the 1900s.
No, but I think
tablets and stuff. So yeah. Do you think it's just imagination?
No, I think there's a lot of iconic symbols in medieval art that you have to know something about medieval art to realize what those little objects are. Often they're painted as angels or some kind of supernatural beings. Now, of course, the ufologists might say, well, yeah, they didn't call them spaceships. They didn't know about that then. They called them what was the sort of the cultural model of their day, which were angels and demons and whatnot. Yeah, maybe, but I don't know. It's still a stretch. I think before we can say anything definitive, we really do need a spacecraft or an alien body or something like that. You know, not a film.
Well, but maybe we have it. We just haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, maybe, but that's
you
like...
You haven't, I haven't.
That's like the weapons of mass destruction. How do we know that Saddam Hussein had them? Because we can't find them. Because he moved them. Well, no, sorry. That's not going to hold water. You actually have to find positive evidence in favor of the claim, not just negative evidence that that it was erased. And that's the problem with the government cover-up explanation. You know, maybe, like Stan Friedman's, you know, fond of holding up those letters with the big blacked-out redacted paragraphs and whatnot. Well, we know governments do that anyway for national security reasons. So how do you know that particular one means extraterrestrial instead of just national security? We need something more positive.
Agenticity. What is that?
Agenticity is the tendency to infuse patterns with intentional agents. That is, when I use the analogy of the hominid on the plains of Africa, the rustle in the grass or the dangerous predator, well, rustle in the grass is an inanimate force. It's just the wind. The wind and the grass, but a dangerous predator implies something else. Dangerous, it implies intention and agency, that there's a predator who wants me. that predator knows I'm alive, and he wants me for lunch. And even the words I use, he wants. The predator wants me. Well, that implies intention and agency to him. So we tend to do this, whether it's gods or ghosts or angels or demons or aliens, and we tend to infuse our natural world with these animistic spirits. And hunter-gatherers are described by anthropologists as of having animism, or the ancient Greeks and Romans as practicing polytheism, or we, monotheism. But in a way, they're all forms of agents, as a form of agenticity, where you just assume that there's some hidden force at work. And in a way, conspiracy theories are a little bit like this. They're the idea that there's somebody behind the scenes pulling the strings, rather than just natural forces at work. Let's say the economy, is filled with these business cycles that go up and down and largely out of control of any intelligent designers in Washington, D.C., as we've noticed. And so we just, but we kind of turn often to these, it's the Illuminati, these 12 guys in London pulling the strings, these hidden forces at work. I mean, so much of what you discuss on the show is very much agenticity. It's like,
sure.
I think there's
and we all know you're in the CIA, right?
That's right. Yeah. I'm Illuminati number 13.
sent as a disinformation expert.
That's it. Well, I've never gotten a paycheck, damn it. If I'm an agent, I'm an unpaid one.
Well, that's because they wire the cash directly to you, Michael.
I see. Okay, well,
never be a paper trail.
That was Woody Allen's proof for God that he would accept, was a large cash deposit in a Swiss bank account under his name. And so I started using that line, and somebody finally asked me, well, what's the amount to get you to believe in God? I said, all right, $10
million. Brookings once said, talking about UFOs and governments and lies, they did report once, they did a study on, should governments tell us about alien visitations if they occurred? And their conclusion was, no, we can't handle the truth. So they said lie. So, governments do lie.
They do, yeah. Often we find out about it, right? Because that's that problem again of people can't keep their mouth shut. These things come out. I mean, as the joke goes, Clinton couldn't even get a blowjob in the White House. I mean, how's the government going to be pulling off some huge, complex conspiracy when they can't even do simple things like that? I mean, they can't even build barriers in New Orleans. They can't. There's so many things the government can't do competently that all of a sudden they can do these amazing. I mean, for 9/11 to be pulled off as an inside job, and having operatives at work planning explosive devices inside the World Trade Center building without anybody noticing, for months on end, it takes to wire up a building that big, two of them no less, and all the people that would have had to been involved on the inside, and not one of them wants to go on Larry King Live or your show and go, hey, I got a story for you. I know the guy. I dated this guy, and he told me that he did it. You see what happens, like with Tiger Woods, all these women coming out.
Oh, my God, they're coming out of the woodwork now. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
But what about the possibilities that somebody in government knew about it and decided, for whatever reason, they just were going to let it happen? Possible?
Oh, the let it happen. Well, like one person maybe, but...
Maybe one or two.
Even so, after the fact, people, again, want to their 15 minutes. It's hard to keep people to keep their mouth shut.
Michael, they're going to take a little piece of you next. So we're going to open up the phone lines with Dr. Michael Shermer on Coast to Coast AM.